This is the Detroit Sports Podcast Network.
The biggest icon in podcasting.
To this week's edition of Doc and Jock, episode 557 on the Detroit Sports Podcast Network. I am the Doc, John Macaroon. Joining me, my guy, Adam, the Jock Strozinski. We got a big show for you guys. It's opening day weekend. The Detroit Tigers are coming back to Comerica Park to what is probably going to be a standing ovation, having a winning record to start the year. We're going to talk about the Tigers' start, giving people hope that a team with a below-average payroll can win baseball games. The Red Wings are scratching and clawing to try to get to the postseason. The NCAA is just crazy on both sides, the men and the women. We're going to talk about that, and we'll talk about a kicker in the USFL that just sent shockwaves through the Detroit Lions fan base when they saw a guy that's relatively inexperienced kick a 64-yarder at Ford Field. It sent everybody into dream la-la land. Could this guy kick 65-yarders at Ford Field? That'll be fun to talk about, and we'll finish the podcast talking about Brock Wright and the weird recruitment of a tight end that potentially by the time this drops, the decision will be made should the Lions have Brock Wright on their roster. But because we got to talk about it, I know you and I, we love looking online and looking at things that just don't go well in regards to airlines or people running commercial ads and don't even put the proper pronunciation or things like that. You and I get a great kick out of it. And in the realm of you just had one job, the NCAA, I heard this story going on around town, around online regarding a basketball court in the three-point line in a women's tournament. And I'm like, wait a minute. There's no way they marked the three-point line incorrectly. I was wrong. The NCAA really, really dropped the ball and had egg all over their face. What the hell is going on with this story? Give me the details, because when I saw it, it just hit me as, oh my God, another situation in which the basics of someone doing their job was not followed.
Yeah, so this happened this past weekend. It was out in Phoenix. It was for Phoenix was hosting an Elite Eight set of games, and the court was mismarked. The three-point line was mismarked, and it wasn't by a little bit. It was by like a foot and a half. So they could have retaped the three-point line, but it would have took about an hour and a half. You have TV networks that have a bit of a say in all of this, and basically they decided to just play through it. To me, it screams of just utter disrespect. At this time, the women's game is probably more popular than the men's game, I would say. And I say that just because they actually have stars. They've got faces. They've got Angel Reese. They got Caitlin Clark. They've got a ton of women that you can kind of point to and you're like, oh yeah, I know them. I mean, just the other day we had Iowa taking on LSU, and it was one of the biggest college basketball games this year. It's a women's game. It's for a chance to go to the Final Four. So, you know, it's just disrespect again of the women's game and of what's going on. Like you said, you had one job. All you had to do was just set the court up properly. And to me, it doesn't seem like it's that hard when you are tasked with this job to make sure the floor, make sure the court is installed correctly. The 3-point line is incredibly important. Caitlin Clark showed you that the other day when she went, 9 for 20 from beyond the arc. Like, she poured in 41 points. I mean, the fact that I'm even talking about a women's game on our show shows you how important the women's game has become. And for you to not get the basic dimensions of the court right is mind-boggling to me. It's absolutely crazy. I was blown away by this because when I seen it, I was like, that can't be right. Just like you, your reaction, that can't be right. And then you see the video proof and you see the evidence of this and you see how much it was off by. It's not like it was off by, you know, an inch or two. It was a pretty large distance, especially when we're talking about, you know, a couple of feet here. It was enough to where this is definitely going to impact this game. It's really, really unfortunate. I think the more unfortunate thing is because you're kind of constrained by TV networks and they have so much pull, you can't even get it corrected. And the fact that it was going to take an hour and a half to get it fixed, to me, was kind of nuts as well. So it just mind-blowing that the NCAA just can't get out of their own way sometimes. And you look at just kind of where we've been for most of the season. You go back to football season. You see what the NCAA had to go through with Michigan. Now we're here in college basketball, and this is going on with the women's game. NIL is constantly under scrutiny, and the NCAA is kind of like, dup, 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 dup. We're good. It's just the NCAA just constantly kind of fouling things up, for lack of a better term, and pun intended, not being able to get out of their way. In this case, it impacted a women's game and the three-point line. It's outrageous.
Yeah, I got a beef too, because for some reason, the NCAA decided to put the Michigan hockey team in the same region and bracket as the Spartans. And even though the Spartans whooped on the Michigan Wolverines 4 out of 6 times this year,
all season long, they beat their ass.
All year long.
The biggest game. That was a beautiful game. I don't know if you watched any of it. I watched a ton of it.
Yeah, it was sick, dude. When he made that pass, my jaw was just like, good God. But look, in the end, it's hockey, and it was entertaining. And I've been to, you know, several Duel in the D's. And for the time being, you know, for the last couple years, Michigan just would whoop on Michigan State. Well, for once, you know, Michigan State, who did make a deep run and won the NCAA, you know, in the run of this podcast, they just fell short. And okay, fine. It hurt. It stings to lose to your rival. But at least Michigan State, with their new head coach, is taking a step forward. And Michigan rebounded nicely after some scandal as well. So, you know, look. In the end, with the NCAA, I want to ask you this. Did Caitlin Clark get you to pay a little bit of attention? Because on Monday evening, it was sick, bro. It was a sports fan's really dream night. You had the Tigers, Red Wings, and Pistons. And you could definitely ignore the Pistons because you knew, okay, it'll be competitive, and then they'll lose in the fourth quarter, which exactly happened. They're up by 7 with 11 minutes left, and they're going to lose. Sheila Hemp was there, which is great. Good for her. But she got to take in a piss-poor product and a team that, no matter what, finds ways to lose and is just an awful 13-62 basketball team. That's just the embarrassment of the entire NBA. So they were off my radar, but I definitely had the two screens going. I got a television and a couple laptops. So I had the Wings game, I had the Tigers game on, and I was checking out the women, because the Angel Reese, obviously seeing her on SI, and Caitlin Clark just being the wizard of the court, I was like, man, this is really hyped up. And of course, the coach of LSU getting all the pub for defending herself from really a hit piece that wasn't a hit piece, that was just a profile. So it was dramatic. There was a lot of things going on, and it stemmed from last year's title game where Angel Reese really did the trash-talking thing galore in Caitlin Clark's face, and Caitlin Clark got revenge, and she moves on to the Final Four. Look, I don't want to say this disrespectfully, but look, Caitlin Clark's a wizard. She's great, but women's basketball is just a little bit more sloppy than what you would be used to if you follow the NBA. It's a lot of turnovers, a lot of, you know, it's just a step below. If you start with that vantage point and you say, okay, Caitlin Clark is just an Angel Reese, or just a step above, you can enjoy it, but it's a lot of missed layups. It's a lot of, you know, just a couple of notches above high school top end if you're a real basketball fan. But I don't want to disparage the women. It's fun to watch. It's enjoyable, but it's nowhere near the top of the board in regards to comparison to the WNBA. In fact, WNBA is a lot more cleaner and things like that, a lot more fundamentally sound. College is just, you know, you got some people that, you know, are scholarship players that in the end are going to be selling insurance or selling real estate. But bottom line, it got me to pay attention, and Caitlin Clark rose to the occasion, and Iowa basketball has been something to follow throughout the course of the entire season. And that's credit to her. And credit to Angel Reese for those two programs really getting the attention nationally, probably more attention on them than the men's NCAA.
Yeah, I mean, look, this is I get what you're saying, right? It's not as fluid of a game. It's not as
crisp,
as clean of a game. There are stretches where nobody's really scoring, and there's fouls and bad passes. I totally get what you're saying. But going into this game, you and I both love pro wrestling. This had the build of a pro wrestling match. This was there was revenge from last year. You had everything that took place last year with Angel Reese basically giving the choking sign and the throat slashing sign to Caitlin Clark. Caitlin Clark has put on a dominant show all season long. Honestly, you could correlate this to what Cody Rhodes has done since last year. Last year, the big thing was Cody Rhodes. Was he going to finish his story? Last year, was Caitlin Clark going to win the women's NCAA championship for Iowa? And they end up losing. Cody ends up losing. All right. Now it's this year-long build, and Caitlin's building momentum. Angel Reese still in the driver's seat, and she's doing her thing in LSU, and all those things are kind of going on, very much like Roman Reigns doing his thing, just kind of going on. And now these two clash for the right to get to the Final Four. And look, you can make the argument in college basketball, the Final Four tends to be looked upon as an incredibly big deal, almost bigger than what the actual national championship game is. And in this case, these two finally meet. And does Caitlin Clark have enough to get Iowa over the hump? And she poured it on, man. 41 points, 9 of 20 from three-point land. She had a hell of a game. And it was nuts. You had two bitter rivals, two girls who really pull no punches, and they talk a lot of trash to each other. They're very demonstrative on the floor. It is nasty when they get on the court together because they challenge each other. They go head to head and they butt heads. And in the end, Cody Rhodes ends up defeating Roman Reigns, and Caitlin Clark is now going to the Final Four while Angel Reese is going home. The defending champ LSU is now exited the tournament. So to me, it was fantastic just because of the storylines that you had. You don't really get enough of that in sports. You know, back when we had the Red Wings taking out the Avalanche, right? There was always this storyline. There was always this thread that was weaved between the two teams. You don't see that a lot in sports, and this had it, and it was fun to watch for a Monday night. I thought it was fantastic. And then you mix in the Tigers that we're going to talk about here. You mix in the Red Wings getting a big win, beating Tampa Bay, got a much-needed 2 points. We're basically down to essentially a final week of games in the season. We've got 7 games left in the season. Friday night, they'll be taking on the New York Rangers. And look, the Detroit Red Wings are basically holding on to a final playoff spot. Now, Washington, at the moment that we're recording, they have 2 games in hand on the Detroit Red Wings. But the Wings are in the conversation. They're on the graphic. They have a chance to punch a ticket to get into the playoffs. Do the Red Wings hold on long enough to get into the playoffs, or is this going to be one of those things where they look back at this season? I think at one point they were like, they won 3 games out of like 15 in the middle of that awful slump that they had. They just couldn't buy a win. Are they going to look back at that slump and be like, man, we really shot ourselves in the foot. All we had to do was eke out a couple of wins. Or are they going to put it together late in the season and get into the playoffs? And usually when you put it together this late in the season, you get on a bit of a run and you're able to make some noise in the playoffs. And that was what we kind of predicted probably a month ago before they had that awful stretch. Do they do that, or is this going to be one of those things where it just kind of crumbles right before them? How do you see it playing out for the Detroit Red Wings?
Well, first and foremost, it was a pleasure to see them beat the Lightning 4-2. That was a nice performance. Here's the biggest indictment of the Red Wings is that we don't know which team and which brand of hockey they're going to show up and play.
Very Jekyll and Hyde.
Yes, it's unbelievable in regards to the effort level, the crispness. It's like, are you guys really waiting until the final 8 games of the year to turn on the light bulb? I mean, come on. It's a big indictment. It's a big indictment to the coaching staff. It's a big indictment to the roster that you had the stretch where you were 9 points clear, and you go through a 10-game stretch where you get a minimal points, 1 or 2 points, an awful March, a completely disastrous month of March. It came out of the blue. And yeah, partly it was due to Dylan Larkin being hurt. But at the same token, you wouldn't expect that they would really go through a slump where you get just a handful of points. You would think that, okay, maybe 500, just a little bit below. Opportunities were wasted. And to me, I have no clue, because if the Wings typically, if they can get good goaltending, if Petrie and the others can stop making boneheaded mistakes and they can force the action and stop playing in their own zone, then I think this is a team that can score goals and do some things. I think Dylan Larkin, definitely an emotional leader. But far too often, you're not seeing the goal production when you need to. It was good to get the point against Florida, but the desperation level is there, but maybe not to the level that I would like. I just don't. And here's, you know, I was thinking about it because I was driving home and I knew we were going to talk Red Wings. And here's what I thought. You know, I'm a psychologist and, you know, my spidey senses always turn on, and I could be wrong, but to me, there's a lot of different ways a message can be received. And sometimes a message can be received by a roster in a locker room that maybe is incorrect than the message was intended. I believe, when I was thinking about it, just sitting in the car for a minute, and I'm like, okay, thinking about the Red Wings just for a second, I said to myself, you know, when Yzerman didn't make that move to get players to add one or two, it probably sent the message, oh, Stevie doesn't think we're going to win it. So it kind of had the feeling of a air coming out of the balloon type thing for that locker room. Whereas he was thinking, well, maybe we don't want to sacrifice anything. It's not like to say that, yeah, clearly the team's not a Stanley Cup contender, but he felt like they had enough to at least make a playoff push to get there. But I truly believe if I'm sitting there as an athlete and I'm like, all right, let's go. We need one more horse, two more horses. Steve, bring us the guys. That tells us, to me, you go out and you make a move for a guy that can put the puck in the net or a big, tall defenseman, and you got a big dude that you bring in and you paraded as this is the move. I think it would have sent a shockwave through the entire roster for the Red Wings. And instead, I think it had the opposite effect. It had the effect of, oh, Stevie probably doesn't believe in us. We're probably not that good. And that's the way it looked like they played. From the time it was announced that Stevie didn't make the deal, the play on the ice has been piss poor. So I think Stevie should have made a better move other than bringing up their own. And for him to say that publicly, to say, well, I feel like we got enough, clearly you didn't, and it was a big mistake. I feel like this team could have won a round in the postseason instead, because do you really want to get to the postseason only to get your tail kicked in and your roster get spewed all over the ice by the Rangers? They're bigger, faster, stronger, much better, and they're going to kick your ass, and you're going to lose 4-1. So to me, it just kind of felt like a wasted opportunity to send a signal by Steve Yzerman that, hey, we believe this team can do something.
See, I think Steve Yzerman sent that exact signal. I think it had the inverse effect of what he was trying to do. I think he was trying to motivate these guys, and it basically deflated them. I think everything you said is accurate, and I think the way the team received it was not what he was counting on. I thought he thought that this would help motivate these guys, get these guys on their game, and get them more dialed in, and instead, it seemed like it took the air right out of their sails and kind of sunk that ship. Now, I would love for the Red Wings to make the playoffs. I don't care if they get dismantled in that first round. Like I said before, if you can get hot enough to get into the playoffs, you generally are going to be a hard out for somebody. So I think for the Detroit Red Wings, get hot enough, secure your playoff spot, and become a hard out for somebody. You know, if you end up losing, you know, 4-3 in that first round of games, so be it. But I think you can make it really difficult. I think you can get to that second round. If you get into that second round, you'll probably get murdered because everything gets ratcheted up a little bit more, and you'll probably end up losing a series 4-1 or maybe even 4-2 if you're really on your game. But I think just get into the playoffs, become a difficult out for somebody, and let the pieces fall where they may. I think at this moment in time, the team needs experience in the playoffs. And I think as far as what's going on with this program, right, with how they're trying to build this, with what they're trying to do and trying to reestablish a bit of an identity, you need to show progress. And just getting there and being in the conversation for that final week isn't enough progress. You have to get into the playoffs. You have to basically cross that finish line and be able to check that box off the list, because there's a bit of a way things have to go for this team. And specifically in hockey, this is usually how it goes. Usually, your young team, you have trouble figuring out how to win games. Then that young team kind of grows up a little bit more, and then you have a bit of a hard time figuring out how not to lose games. And then after all of that, you kind of make this effort, you round out, and you're able to push, and you're able to just about get to the playoffs. You don't really get there, though, and you fall a little bit flat on your face. And then after that, you pick it up and you're able to get into the playoffs. And then you get beat really bad in the playoffs. And then from there, you come back, you win a series or two. And then they add a couple more pieces. And that core now has that experience. And you're able to make these runs. And you're able to be considered a team that is a legit Stanley Cup contender. I feel like the Wings are kind of in that purgatory, right? That no man's land where they're like either just kind of falling short and falling flat on their face, or they're just able to get into the playoffs and then get murdered by whoever they see. That this team has to be able to take that next step, and they have to be able to definitively do it. So I want to see them get into the playoffs. I believe they have enough to get into the playoffs. I think the big issue is, what does Washington do? Again, Washington, two more games than the Red Wings have. Those two games could be a gigantic difference when we get to the end of the season. We'll see how that plays out. But I think the Wings have to take this step. If we're going to talk about progress, we're going to talk about the Eiser plan, we're going to talk about what Steve Yzerman is putting together, we have to take that next step, and the Red Wings have to make it into the playoffs.
Yeah. How disappointed would you be if they didn't make it? Would you be like, okay, how hot would Yzerman's seat be? Because it feels like he's got a lot of support. It feels like people are angst, you know, there's a lot of anxiety and angst regarding what the hell happened this year because of the potential. But to me, I just think that Steve Yzerman's got to do a better job in terms of really balancing. It's a tough balancing act regarding playing for the present and playing for the future. A lot of young cats, a lot of good prospects in the Wings organization. But at the same token, you still got to get some experience in the postseason. And it just hasn't kind of been inspiring to see the way that they've played, especially when we're using words like collapse and uninspired and the way in which they've played. So it's disappointing at the highest level, because you would think that a team that's led by Steve Yzerman would kind of have a little bit more grit, and they don't got it.
Yeah, look, it would be incredibly disappointing. We're what, 5 years into this rebuild plan? So it means going into year six, now you have to make the playoffs. And like, I think his seat would be incredibly hot going into next season. I don't think there would be any way we could kind of talk about this other than, look, Steve Yzerman better make some moves, better get this team into the playoffs. You better see some progress. Otherwise, what are we doing here? Why? Why are we still doing this? It would probably be time for a conversation of, do we have to move on? Do we have the right guy as general manager? Because it would be a lot of the same. You're just kind of, the names have changed and some of the faces have changed, but you're still getting the same results that you were getting with Ken Holland. You know, maybe your books are in a little bit better order, and maybe your pipeline's a little bit better. But if you just have a bunch of C-level, D-level talent in your pipeline, doesn't mean a damn thing, because you're not getting to the playoffs. So what are we really doing? What did we really change? What has the Yzerman plan really brought you? It hasn't really brought you anything. All it brought you was Alex DeBrincat, and it brought you Patrick Kane on a one-year deal. I mean, that's all you've gotten. You know what I'm saying? So yeah, he has to do something. This team has to make the playoffs. One, to stave off the angry fans at Steve Eichmann's doorstep, ready to burn the house down because they haven't made the playoffs for another year. But two, again, like I said, you got to show progress. And the only way to show progress is to get into the playoffs and do something. And look, we've talked about a lot of progress with the Red Wings. Tigers look like they're making some progress. Ooh. They've opened the season with a sweep of the White Sox in Chicago. They've impressively won games in a lot of different ways. They're going to come home on opening day, which will be taking place on Friday. They're going to have a winning record. This is a team that is in this early stretch of games. This is where they usually are struggling to get out of the gate. They are playing white-hot baseball right now. What do you think the strength of this team is, and what do you think it's going to be the strength this year? What are they going to be able to lean on to help get some of these wins? Last week, you and I quickly talked about it. We didn't think this team had enough to get to the playoffs. This time right now, this team is playing some plus baseball. They're racking up some wins early. This is usually when they kind of falter. They get out of the gates really, really slow, and they get really, really far behind, and they can't dig their way out of it and make that playoff run when they get a little bit hot later in the year. Right now, they're playing some really good baseball early in the season. Yeah, these aren't great teams that they're taking advantage of, but that's part of the game. You take advantage of the teams that you can, and you get the wins when you can. But what do you think this team will be leaning on as we get into some of these tougher matchups and into these tougher series as the season goes on?
Well, it's pretty clear they're going to lean on their pitching. because, my God, they got some studs, flamethrowers. And A.J. Hinch, you can see one of his skills is the ability to mix and match what he's got out there in regards to the talent that he's got. The use of Foley has been unbelievable. Shelby Miller, you got Lang, you got guys that are doing their thing. And you recognize, Maeda is probably going to be the outlier in terms of the starters. But if you can kind of weather the Maeda storm in April, where I guess he kind of struggles mightily in the first month of the season, if, Tarik Skubal had an ace performance. So to me, and this is crazy, that this is the fun part to talk about with this team, is that, and when you look at it, Brad Holmes is kind of putting this kind of thing out there as well, not paying big money deals, kind of having guys that outkick their coverage and you get more out of guys. I think a certain portion, larger than maybe I originally thought, not only like having a winner out there on the diamond or the field, but they also like doing it cheaply. I mean, I get it. It's actually really rewarding to say, damn, we're like $50 million underspending and we're getting overproduction from a bunch of guys, a Carson Kelly, the likes of a Kanya that are coming in and doing some things, getting hits, So the fan base of Detroit loves cheap athletes that kind of overexceed what their pay is. And that's fine. But at the same token, you can't tell me that a JD Martinez wouldn't up the offensive level, because the offense still is a work in progress. You went an entire game against the Mets until the 10th inning without scoring. So, and you have a huge hole in Javi Baez, who's almost a guaranteed out, and he's working through some things. And he's basically a guy that they're counting on to at least not make errors on defense. So while, yes, it's great to get off to the great start, I just think that if you would have also invested in the team as well, I think then the prospects of this team winning in the postseason would be a little bit greater. Because now, okay, good. I predicted on our Twitter page, at Detroit Podcast, at least over 85 wins. I think if anywhere between 85 and 90, it's entertaining. But this is a gritty group, and this is something that the Tigers and the Lions are trying to accomplish. And now it's going to be the new buzzword with all the teams around town is grit. Get some guys that are going to be hard workers, maybe not the Michigan State plan, which I saw and lived through. I definitely prefer five-star guys and take them to the next level too when you got a manager like A.J. Hinch. But to me, cuz, we can sit and complain about the spending all we want. But in the end, they got to make money, and they just are not willing to drop the hammer on a guy making $15 million plus in free agency. Maybe it would have been Chapman, maybe been J.D. Martinez. You could have looked at a pitcher as well. But by and large, which is good, and again, we'll pay the compliments, it appears that Scott Harris and A.J. Hinch, the marriage is going to be fruitful. They're going to find guys that have quality at-bats, that take counts deep into the that don't just swing at everything. They're going to have an approach. They're going to have a strategy. A.J. Hinch is a clear-cut, valuable manager that anybody would respect. So to me, while we can complain and wish for more, and as fans, we always should, there still is a level of appreciation that the strength of this team is something that we can all like. Pitching, defense, that 1-0 opener was spectacular. I liked it. I was like, oh man, this could, 2 hours, the pace was good, and you're getting clutch. The only thing really that a guy like me would argue is awful in terms of the entertainment is that god-awful home run thing. The pizza on a stick is corny. And good job, Spencer Torkelson. You're kissing the ass of the owner. Good job. We all know what you're doing. But in terms of the fan base, we ain't down with that. We don't like that. Do something a little bit more, conducive to professional athletes. You look like a college team that's trying to suck up to the president or something. But in the end, cuz, a winning record in terms of the home opener, I think that this is a team that this fan base can get behind and rally behind real easily.
Yeah, and look, I agree with you. I think the strength of this team is going to be that starting rotation as well as the bullpen. And you're right. It would be a lot better, a lot nicer to see a guy like a J.D. Martinez added to this offensive lineup, a guy with a bat who can come in and help drive home some runs. This team, for the entire year, is going to have to scratch and claw and grind out wins. And nothing's going to be easy for this team, which is why it's really nice. It's impressive to see what they've done in this early stretch of games. You've got a team that is Yeah, taking advantage of a team like the White Sox, who are not good. Taking advantage of a team like the Mets, who are also not good. You're going to be opening up against a team like Oakland, who, again, not very good. You can take advantage of these teams and really build upon this, get some confidence early. Like I said before, this is normally the stretch of the season where this team drops 10, 11 games in a row, and they're playing from behind the eight ball. They're normally like 2-13 for their first 15 games. They usually are brutal to open the year. They might win on opening day, but after that, they kind of lose a couple of games. They go on these weird skids. So take advantage of the teams you're playing now. Win a couple of games. Get yourself in a position where you give yourself a little bit of room for error down the stretch. And look, you brought up Javi Baez. Javi Baez is an automatic out. This guy is struggling. He's been struggling since last year. I don't know how to fix him. I don't know what you can do. It's not like you can just send him down. You know, it's one of those things where this team has done everything in their power to kind of boost him up, make him feel like he's not the problem. He is a problem. He is a monster issue. He is earning a ton of cash, and he is giving you zero production. That's where a guy like a J.D. Martinez or insert major league veteran bat who can hit the ball here, that's where they would make a bigger difference on this team and help ease some of those games where you've got to scratch and claw to get wins. Javi Baez is hurting you right now. I don't believe this guy makes it to the All-Star brink. I think the Tigers are going to be forced to DFA him. Look, you and I talked about this before on a couple of different shows. Athletes love the competition. They love the routine. They love what they do. All right? Sometimes, though, just as fast as it comes, it goes. And in Javi Baez's case, this is now going on two and a half years, maybe 3 years. He's really been slipping for about five now, but the Tigers signed him, took a chance on him, and he has not paid dividends at all. At a certain point, you're going to have to make the hard decision. You're going to have to let him go because, to me, it just doesn't make sense to hold on to him and keep paying him money when all he's doing is hurting your team. Pay him money, let him go sit somewhere else. Let him just go away. Bring somebody else up. This is a team where Scott Harris talked about we can't have veteran bats clogging up and taking hits away from young talent. Well, right here's a veteran bat clogging up hits and taking away young at-bats. Bring up one of your young guys, slot him in at shortstop, and see what they've got. Because Javi Baez is going to be an albatross around this team all year long. I don't see any way he makes it to the All-Star break. Do you think the Tigers actually pull the trigger, DFA him, or does he get through the All-Star break? And at that point, maybe the Tigers do something, or maybe they just kind of rotate him or bench him like they did last year.
The only hope can be that he catches on fire and a contending team just makes a ridiculous offer, which is very, very much an outside-the-box thing, and it's not likely to happen. So to me, that's a lot of money to scratch, and you just do what you can, get as much out of them, and maybe next year you do it. But right now, winning cures all. And as long as they're winning, they can put them 7th, 8th in the lineup, and it's going to be okay. So it sucks. It's wild to see his two-strike approach. He just struggles. I mean, everybody knows to throw him a slider away. It's so nasty. And look, it's not easy in regards to the position that he's in, but really I just don't think you can just dump him. It doesn't seem like that's the strategy. You and I could do it, and we just would scratch the check and move on. But it's a lot of money, and I just think that AJ Hinch is just going to respect the guy, keep him on the roster, and figure out the best way if he can get some timely hits later on in the year. And you just take what you can get. It sucks because he's not a fan favorite. The crowd groans online. He's taking a lot of heat. He's the least popular member of the Tigers. So it'll be interesting to see the reception. Now, if it gets worse and the errors pick up, I think his defense will play a large part in regards to what AJ Hinch thinks about him. But do I think he makes it to the All-Star break? I got to say, yeah. It's unfortunate. It's just one of those guys that, look, it's the Alavila special.
Do you think it's because of the money?
Yeah, of course.
Because he's a veteran, so they're going to keep paying him because you're paying him anyways?
You way overpaid for a guy that's not Carlos Correa, not have the production, and it's a big whiff. And in Detroit, we don't like that. We don't like guys making that much money and being an albatross on the books. So that's what stinks. But in the end, man, you got to look, not everything can be perfect. I think the offense is something just to stay and pay attention to. But cuz opening day's here, Friday. What are you going to do? How are you taking it all in? It's going to be fun. I think the weather's going to be just okay, 55, just good enough to put on a sweater and get down there and have some cocktails. My plans are not exactly sure yet. I put in for a credential, but I feel like I'm going to get iced out, at least for the first game. Maybe I'm going to go Sunday, check out for the first time the opportunity to see what they're all about. But my plans are up in the air. I might work in the morning, might get out there, might not. But in the end, which is fun, is DVR and Tigers games is a lot more fun, and the opportunity to get down there is great. They invited me, and I'll give you the review in a second. The Comerica Park, the experience was fun.
I'll be filming a lot of the pre stuff, a lot of the stuff that you'll see on the news. I'll be filming it all. So I'm going to be working. And at this moment in time, I've been working doubles for the last, I don't know, month and a half or so. So if anybody out there is interested in being a helicopter photographer, please reach out to me. We're looking to fill a position. But I will be, I'll be filming a bunch of stuff, and I'll be working pretty much the entire day. So that's how I'll be taking it in. When the game is actually going on, I'll probably be back at my office, watching some stuff and kind of keeping track of what's going on with the game. So I know when I got to get back up there, to film everybody leaving and the celebrations that are going on downtown. But what I'll be doing.
So when the grainy footage starts showing up on television, we'll know you took a day off. We'll be like, oh, that's Adam's guy. He trained that guy. And so,
yeah, exactly.
So what's the, obviously we know the worst thing that can happen in the helicopter situation, but in terms of your photography and stuff, what's the worst thing that you could do? Is it to have a shot that you got to get and then to send like a blank video to producers? Like, what's the worst thing that realistically could happen where you're like, God damn it, a negligent idiot did this?
So worst thing that could happen is your equipment's not working, right? So you're generally transmitting live and you're recording just in case. And if, say, what you're trying to transmit isn't transmitting, that'd be pretty awful.
Yeah.
because then it's, you go into frustration mode and you go into like panic mode because you've got producers that are like, well, we're not receiving anything. Why aren't we receiving stuff? So now you got to try to troubleshoot everything.
Yeah.
it's hard to troubleshoot stuff in the air.
Right.
A lot of times, I'll be honest with you, when you work with television stations, and I work with all four in the area, usually the television stations do not think that it's their fault. They tend to think that it's your fault. But a lot of times, they've got old equipment, and their equipment kind of breaks down and sometimes needs to be reset. And so then you're trying to walk them through that, and you're telling them that, and they're like, well, it's still not working. I was like, did you turn it off and turn it back on? No, it's not the problem. Okay, I bet if you tried that, it would work. And 9 times out of 10, you power it down, give it a second, turn it back on. It works just fine.
Exactly.
So I, you know what, though? I am lucky enough to where usually when I'm working, the guys that I work with in the receive bays, they are fantastic. The guys over at Fox, too, they're great. Channel 4 has a couple of guys that are fantastic. Channel 7's got some really good people as well. So they all do a really, really nice job.
Got it. So my first day will be like, God damn it, he sent a fucking video with black all over it, nothing in it. Or it's like, we can't see what the hell is shooting. And, and I'm like, I sent it. And they'll be like, did you use this parameter? And I'm like, no. Yeah, okay. So that's funny as hell. Oh, man.
I think the most frustrating thing is you'll be on a shot and you'll be holding it. And in my case, I'm working with three stations live, and I've got a fourth station that basically is video to record. So you'll be holding a shot forever and a day, and you're trying to give the producer and the station a really cool shot. And you've got it. And we're constantly moving. And all of a sudden, a building will get in the way. Or
yeah, exactly.
They'll tell you, hey, we're coming to you in 2 minutes. And you're like, okay, cool. And you're holding it. Now it's 3 minutes. Now it's 4 minutes. And now you can't hold the shot anymore. And then they come to you. And it's like, I'm giving you a really bad shot. And if you would have just took me, I don't know, 120 seconds earlier, we would have had something great. And sometimes the magic just isn't there because timing is sometimes an issue.
The magic better be there on Friday, because it's the A's, I believe, right? A series I think you can probably...
It is the A's.
You can handle. Another sweep, baby. Another sweep to get off to a great start, and it'll be an opportunity for the Tigers to really send the fan base home the opening weekend with some really good things to cheer about. I think the fans, at least through the early part of the season, are going to have a lot to cheer about. And we'll see how this team handles some success. It's a young team. The one thing, though, I guess from us, from Doc and Jock, that clearly would need to improve, Torkelson and Riley Green got to get into gear. Like, let's go, boys. You're the heart of the order, and you're the worst on the team besides Javi Baez. And let's go. A lot of strikeouts, a lot of opportunities wasted. You guys got to step it up. It's still early, so the offensive woes are okay and tolerable, but let's go. The season started, and if those two get into gear, look out. Then the offense can get off the schneid and be something that everyone can be proud of. So, Cuz, where were you when the unbelievable kicker from the Michigan Panthers launched a 64-yard field goal? Everybody in town was like, whoa, sign him. Everybody was like, whoa. Cuz, outside of the roster, kicker stories at All Lions just blow up. Everybody loves talking about the competition, Money Badger, what's the issue, what's going on, what the hell's going on with this kicking game? Has it been something that's been wasted? It's something that's overlooked, underrated, overrated? It's crazy what's going on with the kicking situation, and especially when you're indoors. And I think that when people have kind of looked at the Lions kickers, they've kind of recognized, you know, you had Jason Hansen, he was solid, and you had Matt Prater. That gave you a couple decades of reliable kickers. And since Prater's gone and they didn't value the position anymore, didn't want to pay it, it's kind of gone downhill. It's been a revolving door. And when Jake Bates kicked that field goal, I think the story that first came out was wrong, in that the last time he kicked a field goal was in high school. Well, that was actually not true. That it's been the first time he's actually successfully ever made a field goal competitively, I think is what I heard in the end, in the storytelling. Well, at least we know he didn't kick anything in college, and in such a big moment that your first kick in a competitive environment in at least several years is a made 64-yarder that just sent everybody into a tailspin. So what was your reaction to it, and what's been your observation of the Lions kicking game? Because it's a lot of people take it a lot of different ways. People say, well, you know, Badgley wasn't all that bad. They didn't really count on him because the offense is so aggressive, and he's not that bad, but he lost his job to Riley Patterson because the secret is, in practice, he ebbs and flows in practice, and that's the marquee sign of NFL coaches and special teams coaches, is 1 week he'll be unbelievable in practice, and boom, they have no problem. They know what he's about. And then the next week, he's terrible. And then they have to be like, oh, we got to get somebody. And then they feel more confident in Riley Patterson. And then that's been a revolving door. So with the Money Badger, it's not that he's a bad kicker. It's just that he hasn't been able to consistently in practice make it so that the coaches are just like, that's our guy.
Yeah, so to answer your first question very early on, I was actually rearranging my basement when the notification came across on my phone, and I had to stop and watch it, and I was blown away. I was like, holy cow, I can't believe this. So that was when I first got notified of it. But to me, I think the shocking thing is, right, and this just kind of goes to prove it, there are good kickers out there all over the place. You don't necessarily have to invest a draft pick in order to get a kicker. You just have to be open-minded enough and go look for one and be able to find that talent. This is a guy who kicked damn near a 70-yard field goal. It measured 64 yards, but it still had distance on it. He was good from 70. And what that tells me is the Detroit Lions, as an organization, one, don't value the kicking position. Two, do not invest enough time in the kicking position. And three, this all makes sense if you really look at what is this front office, what is this brain trust. You look at Chris Spielman. Chris Spielman, a hard-nosed, gritty, edgy guy. He was a linebacker, right? He was the rip your head off, shit down your neck, duct tape your head back on type of linebacker. They don't care about kickers. You look at Dan Campbell. Dan Campbell's the man's man, right? He's the everyman guy. He doesn't value a kicker. He's a tight end. He's like, F those kickers. We don't care about them. You look at Brad Holmes. Brad Holmes doesn't value the kicking position. He's too busy out there worrying about wide receivers. He's too busy worried about offensive linemen, defensive linemen, building through the trenches. this organization, and I think it's a dangerous stance that they have. Look, we can all agree what this team has done, what this organization has done over the course of the last couple of years has been very impressive. But I think they play a dangerous game by not going out there and not fielding and not putting enough resources into the kicking position. You're bringing back a guy that you had here last year that you ended up cutting. You're going out there and you're just kind of trying these retreads. You're not really going out there trying to find anybody who can do anything. And I think the mindset of this team, because you can see how Dan Campbell calls a football game, right? If it's on the other side of the 50, doesn't matter what it is, we're going for it. It could be 4th and 6. We're going for it, you know, because we're in a position where you can't necessarily punt it. And we're in a position where we don't trust our kicker. We need to get it within the 25-yard line in order to send our kicker out there to try to attempt a 37-yard field goal. That's not good enough. At some point, you've seen it kind of this year when they were in the playoffs. At a certain point, you're going to have to go for a field goal. A field goal can kind of turn everything around for you. You would have won that game against San Francisco if one of those fourth downs that you tried some crazy shit on was an actual field goal attempt and you completed it. How many games have we gone through where it was one of those crazy calls that Dan Campbell made on fourth down and we're like, you should have just kicked the field goal. Take the points. Kick the field goal. Call it a day. Keep it moving. Instead, you roll these guys out there who have trouble making extra points. To me, it's absolutely crazy. And I think this right here, this highlights what this organization values as far as kickers, and it's nothing. They do not value the kicker position. They do not value kickers at all. They value a punter. That's why they had no problem making Fox the highest paid punter at one point. But they do not value the kicking position, and they're willing to risk games and just roll the dice for whomever, whatever. Now, Lions have come out, and they did make contact with the kicker that blasted that 64-yarder. But whether they get anything done or not, or whether we see anything different than what we had last year, I don't know, man. I don't necessarily buy it. To me, it is incredibly hard to believe that they're going to do anything different.
Yeah, it's something where they'll have competition, but it feels like the Money Badger is in the lead, and somebody will just have to just blow somebody away. So it's crazy in that the UFL averaged 1.2 million viewers per game during week one, just on par with some lower NBA games and some Major League Baseball games. So that's where this new collaboration, I think this is the combined league with The Rock and the USFL, right? Is this the are we at that point? Yes. Now? Yeah.
Yep.
So
yep. That's what this is. Yep.
Yeah. So this is craziness. And, people are paying attention early on, so we'll see how this all plays out and what goes on with the Lions. Now, to finish off here, I'm curious. Have you, in your evaluation and seeing the numerous mock drafts, I know we're going to cover one from CBS Sports. I know we love the mock draft review, and I love looking at them and breaking them all down too, kind of seeing who goes a little bit before and a little bit after the Lions. Has anybody kind of caught your eye to say, oh, you know, to me, it's just straightforward. It's Keon Coleman because of the fact that he shined with the Seminoles, and he was a key component as well during the last Michigan State game that they won, where Michigan came to town and they had the early on lead, and there was that controversial call where Hutchinson kind of smacked the ball, and the call went the Spartans' way, and the Spartans were trailing at halftime, and everybody was happy on the Michigan side, only to have Michigan State kind of take over and handle business. That was a fun time to be at. Keon Coleman, a part of that team. And unfortunately, you know, he just wanted a 2-year stint. I guess it was expected. That was the deal, that he was coming to grow up and learn and then would end up going back down south. And boy, did he break out. So a wide receiver of that ilk that can be a game changer would be great. Or Jackson Powers Johnson, an offensive lineman, would be fine as well. I think a lot of people are hoping maybe somebody falls that has, you know, the caliber of a Quinyon Mitchell. I know at all Lions will probably break down scenarios in which trying to look at how to go get them by trading up. But in your mind, anybody that you're like, man, this is a dream scenario. If he can fall at 29, that's somewhat realistic.
A guy like Chop Robinson.
Yeah.
Jared Verse, I've kind of seen either really, really high, or I've seen him really, really low. He's kind of all over the place. I look it, to me, Christmas would come if Kenyon Mitchell fell.
Yes, yes.
But I don't believe that's happening. I don't think either one of us believe that's happening. But that would be Christmas Day for me. It would honestly be one of those guys would be fantastic. I don't have a problem with Keon Coleman. I think that's a solid draft pick. I could see the Lions possibly trading out of 29 and moving back into the second round, getting something early in the second, and Keon Coleman being that first guy that they end up taking early in the second round there. But you know, it's becoming more and more evident, the more and more of these mock drafts we look at, that a guy like Kool-Aid McKinstry is going to be there. And I'm wondering if we've got to kind of start wrapping our brains around, is it going to be okay if he's the pick, if he's the guy? This is a guy that I myself am not huge on. I'm not sure where you stand with him. I don't want a cornerback at that position, unless it's an elite guy, unless it's a guy that I see being as valuable as Sauce Gardner. I would much prefer either an offensive lineman or an edge rusher that late, especially if the top two cornerbacks are gone. And the top two cornerbacks, obviously, Kenyon Mitchell and Tyron Arnold from Alabama. Kool-Aid McKinstry's constantly being brought up and constantly being mentioned in this mock draft that we're going to go over. He's available at 29. Do we have to start to make peace with him being the pick at 29?
Yeah, it's interesting because Brad Holmes makes a couple trips a year to the pro days, and he says typically he's reserved, but he always tends to make Alabama. So who was he looking at? Was it the kicker? I think that's probably a safe assumption that's somebody that he looked at. But for sure, Tyron Arnold, and unfortunately, they didn't test all that great. But for Brad Holmes and most evaluators, the combine kind of just confirms what they already know. It doesn't really, unless the workout is so bad that they have to go back and look at it, but they've already got a lot of information. So what Brad Holmes has said is he just takes the information from what he sees at these workouts and kind of confirms what they already know. So to me, I would assume that Kool-Aid McKinstry is high on their board, but at the same token, to the wide receiver that's talented there as well, could be somebody that they look at as well, because Alabama just has a bunch of talent all over the place. So it's just wild to think, because Kool-Aid McKinstry, I think, would take time. I think he could develop in this system. I would probably prefer another free agent, but that's going to be costly. So it's just a tough situation all the way around. But because I guess now we got to open the door and ask, knowing that Cam Sutton turned himself in, knowing that really, if he probably had wise legal counsel, he probably could have negotiated it down to a misdemeanor if that's what the case was. Why did he run? Why didn't he just take care of it 24 hours later? I feel like maybe there was a mental health situation where he got real anxious and felt like he needed to flee and let time pass so that sentiment would go away as people's attention span dissipates. But in my mind, knowing how the legal system kind of works, and if you have a supportive partner that's not going to be, looks like, pressing the matter, then I think he made a mistake in regards to not turning himself in. And maybe the Lions prematurely acted on this, should have waited on it. But I think the factor that drove it was the fleeing. It's like, that's somebody that is clearly not in the right mindset. And when you put it all together, his play is not that good, but man, if you're Cam Sutton, it feels like you maybe didn't take into account that you could basically get a misdemeanor out of this and not have any, maybe not have as bad of repercussions in terms of your career. But with the Lions, you also could say that, you know, they're not going to wait. They're not, because 14 days of the media going, why do you have this kind of guy in your locker room, is probably not the best, especially when your owner is a female. So it was just a while. It was crazy to see, because, you know, you see the athletes and they work hard and they're smiling and they're always presenting themselves. When he walked into that shot, man, he looked like a different dude. He looked like a dangerous kind of dude. And you're just like, oh man. And the mugshot was scary. The mugshot was like, oh man, you don't want to see the athletes that you cover in that spot. But any chance that the Lions reacted a little quickly on the Cam Sutton situation? He's terrible at number one, but he could have been a serviceable number two with some more help.
I don't think so. I think this comes down to what we talked about before. It's all about culture, right? This is something that is a non-negotiable for this team. This is something that this team does not allow. This is something that this team has a very hard-line stance, and they're not going to bend or break those rules, apparently, for anybody. And look, let's be honest. Cam Sutton is not a good enough player for you to go ahead and bend or break those rules.
Yeah.
If this guy was, I don't know, Nick Bosa, you could maybe sit there and have that conversation, maybe talk about it. Or if this guy was, you know, as far as cornerbacks go, if he was Sauce Gardner, we could maybe have that conversation. But Cam Sutton's not good enough. He's not good enough for you to go back on your integrity that you have and go back on what you have built your culture and your foundation on. So it is one of those things where I don't think they acted in haste. I don't think they acted rash. I think they obviously have more information than we have. And I think they used what they had, man. And they made the decision that is kind of the identity of this team, like what goes on inside those four walls. Not what we see on the field, but inside those four walls, you are held to a certain code of conduct. You are held accountable for certain things. This is one of those things that they do not waver on and that they will not give you a second chance on. We're just not dealing with this. And look, maybe it comes down from having a female as an owner. Maybe this is something that both Dan Campbell and Brad Holmes have a hardline stance on as well. This is something that is very valuable to these guys, and this is something that they're not willing to waver on. So, no, I don't think they acted too fast.
Okay.
Are you ready to get into this mock draft real quick?
Yes, do it.
All right, so first four picks are all quarterbacks. Caleb Williams goes number one. Jaden Daniels goes number two. Drake May goes number three. We have a trade at number four. Minnesota moves up and trades their two first-round picks to the Arizona Cardinals, and they select J.J. McCarthy. Mm. Number five is Marvin Harrison Jr. He goes to the Chargers, and the Giants take Malik Nabers at six. Number one offensive tackle in line goes at seven to Tennessee. That's Joe Alt. Jared Verse, the guy we just talked about, goes at pick eight to Atlanta. And Chicago comes back and takes Dallas Turner, the number one edge, off the board at pick nine. Jets take Rome Odunze. Kenyon Mitchell, a guy who we are high on. The Arizona Cardinals end up taking him at 11. This is with one of their first first-round pick from the trade with Minnesota. Tarion Arnold goes right after that. We've talked about both these guys here in this podcast. He goes to Denver. We then kind of slide down this. Cooper DeJean, a guy who we've talked about and has been talked about being in that realm of position for the Lions at 29. Cooper DeJean goes at 15 to Indianapolis. Jackson Powers Johnson, he goes at 16 to Seattle. It's a guy who you are incredibly high on. We've got a couple of other guys. Brian Thomas Jr., another wide receiver, goes to Arizona again with that second pick that they traded for. Dallas Cowboys end up taking Michael Penix Jr. at pick 24. Or I'm sorry, Las Vegas takes Michael Penix Jr. with pick number 24. They have a trade with the Dallas Cowboys. They moved up to get him. Chop Robinson, the guy who we talked about a little bit ago, goes at pick 29 to Tampa Bay. Donnie Mitchell, another wide receiver, goes to Buffalo at pick 28. So now at pick 29, we've got Kool-Aid on the board. We've got Jordan Morgan on the board. We've got Darius Robinson, an edge, on the board. We've got Brock Bowers, a tight end. Sounds like the Lions may be losing a tight end, and Brock Wright. You could have another Brock replace him with Brock Bowers, who's available. Who would you want the Lions to pick out of those guys? You got a tight end, you got an edge, you got an offensive tackle, you got a cornerback.
Yeah, in my opinion, I think by the time this drops, I think the Lions are going to not sign Brock Wright for that money. I think there's a chance, maybe it's like 51-49 in favor of the 49ers because of the fact that he blocks, and that's really imperative. But you still have Shane Zylstra, who the team could call upon to take the next step forward, or you could draft Brock Bowers. And I did an article, Christian did an article for All Lines that kind of talked about maybe a reason to make that bold trade if you feel like you can get Brock Bowers. Kind of harkens back to the Hernandez and Gronk without all the criminality with the Patriots. And you say, well, you know, if you love tight ends, nothing wrong with that. But to me, if that's the scenario of who's on the board, you take Darius Robinson. He's local, loves what the Lions are all about, and I think that the position you get a little bit more productivity, a little bit faster, is the – it's unfortunate, the new rules too as well. You can't, you know, you can't breathe on these receivers. I think that you can never have enough pass rushers. So to me, I would take Darius Robinson and call it a day, and you feature Darius Robinson, Marcus Davenport, and James Houston. Oh, my God. And then you got DJ Reader up front with Ali McNeil. Good Lord, you could just shuffle in for days to have an opportunity. I think you could get a little impact in the playoffs right now with Darius Robinson. Kool-Aid would be great, but I just don't think I'm ready to wait until 27 to see him reach his peak.
Yeah, if it's me, I'm prioritizing Darius Robinson at the edge, then Jordan Morgan, and then Brock Bowers at the tight end, especially if the Lions do not bring back Brock Wright. So Kool-Aid McKinstry would be my last out of those four. In this mock draft, they've got Kool-Aid going to the Lions at pick 29. Brock Bowers goes at pick 32. Darius Robbins goes at pick 31 to San Francisco. And then Jordan Morgan goes to Baltimore at pick 30. Again, I think Lions fans have to start to prepare themselves that Kool-Aid may be the selection at 29, depending on how things play out.
Interesting. All right. Yeah, no, I like the mock drafts. I like what people have been kind of spitting. A lot of Chop Robinson lately, a lot of wide receivers in the mix as well. Check in with all Lions in the Detroit Sports Podcast as we continue to kind of explore which position could the Lions take. Is Adani Mitchell the Texas wideout? Is he a guy that's growing? Is he somebody? Is Xavier Leggett somebody that could be in the mix? A lot of different names, and really it just goes to show you and highlight that the Lions could do a lot of different things, but in my opinion, that Brad Holmes has earned a lot of credibility, and whatever happens and whoever he takes, I think is going to be accepted. All right, cuz I found something. I was scrolling while we were talking, so I want to get your live reaction. Your former boss kind of has been found out to have a voicemail, and a billionaire in Matt Ishbia released this explosive, someone found it, and it's been kind of released. I want to get your live reaction to an ultra-competitive guy that's talking about the competition. I'm certain that you've heard some of this, and I want to get your live reaction to the mindset that a billionaire has to kind of compete.
Hey, buddy, hope you're doing good. Just want to say I love you. We fucking took those cocksuckers down. Fuck them. And we're going to keep fucking sticking it to them forever. Fuck those guys. We're number one. We kick the shit out of them. Brokers are number one. UWM's number one. You're number one. We're all number one together. And fuck them. I fucking hate them with all my heart. And we're going to keep kicking their ass every fucking day. That's why I was here fucking at 4 a.m. again today. I don't give a fuck. We're going to keep kicking ass. And so I love you, man. We talked about it. We waited for weeks to go up. I'm going to win. You're going to win. Both are happening right now. Keep hiring, keep building, keep growing. Let's fucking go.
That's courtesy of the Pablo Torres finds out. Low, bro, I'm certain that kind of mindset was permeated in the position that you were in. And I could maybe see where some people would find that off-putting. But part of me likes that. It's like, fuck Rocket Mortgage. Fuck them. We're UWM and we're the best. And also too, if you research that, some kind of people are saying that in the practices that that company may have allegedly partaked in, maybe predatory practices as well. We don't got to comment on that, but was that the mindset that some of those team leaders had during those celebratory claps in the morning to get your day going?
That is Matt Ishbia in a nutshell right there, man. That is it.
And that was it.
And it permeates the entire complex over there. If you're into mortgages and you're into trying to be brainwashed, go ahead, go work over there, bro.
Yeah, no, understood. Part of me is like, okay, that's a little intense. It's probably, but I feel like that's the mindset that billionaires have to win at that level, especially when you're competing with somebody else. But I always find it funny that people are just so comfortable to release stuff like that in a voicemail, because anybody could play it at any time. Look at us. It made its way to the Detroit Sports Podcast. We fucking won, baby. We're number one and nobody else can touch us. But that's kind of I've worked with people in the practice with that kind of mindset. It's crazy, because it's like a laser focus to compete and win. And it's a Jordan-esque mentality. And it's kind of like the way you look at it, like what it would take to be a successful athlete. You got to have that sole focus to just do that one thing. And then you got to kind of have that edge to, like, I don't just want to win. I want to obliterate everybody. And I just think human beings aren't like most humans, aren't programmed to kind of be like that. They're just kind of programmed to, okay, I want to do the best I can, and hopefully everybody else I see succeed. But the true people that kind of reach that 1% are just like, I want to win, and I want to obliterate everybody else. So, craziness. I was just scrolling, and I'm like, oh my God, this is crazy. I wanted to get your reaction. Make sure you follow Adam on Twitter at AdamRSTROZ. Follow the network at Detroit Podcast. Make sure anywhere that you find your favorite audio content, whether it be Rumble, YouTube, Google, the Apple Store, Spotify, anywhere at all, Podomatic, that you can find audio content, our stuff will be there. Odyssey, iTunes, all those kind of places. Make sure, again, type in Detroit Sports Podcast and our content will find you. Because that was a fun hour. I enjoyed it. It's too fast. I can't wait to recap the opening weekend of Tigers baseball with you next week as we get ever so close to the draft. What's that looking like downtown? Some of the rumors swirling regarding if the Lions are heading toward another free agent or what draft rumors are coming. Make sure you stay tuned to the Twitter page at Detroit Podcast for all the highlights and fun regarding the Detroit Lions. Because I can't wait to fire it up next week for the latest and greatest episode of Doc and Jock.